Chapter 30, Continued.
Hollis left with a jaunty wave, exiting the low gray school building that had long since been converted into a sleepy community center, catering to regularly scheduled congregations of the elderly, the civic-minded, the unvaccinated, the unregistered, and the mentally impaired. The flags out front were limp in the still air of a morning without any atmospheric personality. It was not sunny. It was not overcast. There was no promise of precipitation. The day hung by its pole, waiting for instructions. He looked at the bank of windows, thinking that maybe he would catch a glimpse of Ben. He could see nothing but a reflection of enigmatic sky behind him. He imagined Ben on the other side, watching him drive by. Maybe a bounce and a clap and a pointed finger. Maybe something more quiet and interior. He drove on, looking back in the mirror. He remembered the Vanguard Academy, a lifetime ago. The VA, as they had called it, the Academy. He remembered David's face as he had driven away, disconsolate and suffused with dread. Hollis had actually choked up at the sight of his son in the rearview mirror, had actually felt the knot in his throat and the twinge in the muscle of his heart. His boy. What was he doing, leaving his boy? But he had managed to shake the feeling within 100 feet or so. He had forced himself back into understanding. He was providing David, his boy, with a superior education. Certainly nothing to regret, nothing to get choked up about. It was the Vanguard Academy, for Christ's sakes. How many parents would have killed to give their child such an opportunity? How many parents would have killed to have those kinds of connections? How many parents were able to sacrifice a small fortune, as he had, to ensure that his child's raw intellectual potential was developed early, unfettered by the indiscriminately common education provided by the Ohio public school system? Although not taking his eyes off David, who had stood on the curb looking morosely at the back of the car, Hollis had stiffened himself and accelerated on his way to the office. Sure, David was feeling down, and he did not like to see his children upset. But it was just first-day jitters. That and maybe some resentment that he could not go to Littlefield Middle School with his friends. But David would suck it up. He was smart as a whip, and the academy was where he belonged. He was a Johns, by God, a Johns, and he would rise to the challenge. He had known at the time that David would be surprised at how right Hollis had been. He had known that Susan, too, would be surprised, for she had only grudgingly indulged the monstrous investment and had been far too willing to send their children to public schools. Hollis, however, would not be surprised, and he would not regret the investment. That, by God, was what money was for, investing in your children. The investment had been huge, sure. But he had known that it was well worth the stretch. Still, Susan had had her concerns about the money. He had had to admonish her to stop living in the past and to look more to the future. "You act like I'm still selling houses, Susan. That was 15 years ago. You still act like you don't know if I'll be able to pay the damn electric bill. We could have paid for this even when I was in mortgage loans." Susan had wavered, shaking her head uncertainly and turning back to dicing the celery. Hollis had seen this opening in the debate that had been conducted over many nights, and he had rammed on through. "We're not in Dayton anymore, Susan. This is the big leagues. The money is good. It's good enough." She had stopped her chopping and looked up at him. She had opened her mouth to speak, but he had pushed on. "This is a great opportunity for our son. This is precisely why I work so hard. To take advantage of opportunities like this one, okay?" And Susan had shaken her head and resumed her dicing, saying something like it was still a lot of money. But Hollis had not let up. "Fine, so what? It's a lot of goddamn money. I earned it, and this is how I'm spending it. David is going to Vanguard, and so will Tilly. I'm not skimping on their education, Susan. I won't do it. Besides, you seem to be missing the bigger picture here." It had taken Hollis another hour to re-explain for her the bigger picture, which by Hollis's reasoning was that an investment in the Vanguard Academy would actually make them money in the long run. The bigger picture had involved Charles Compson III, the imposing, ruggedly attractive, statuesque founder of the Vanguard Academy, who in those years had been one of the largest commercial developers in central Ohio, and who had an impressive project record stretching over into Illinois and down into Indiana. Mr. Compson, who had made his first fortune running his father's highly successful Miami-based residential construction company in Florida, had settled comfortably into his own, building and developing far-flung commercial projects with no nexus to his Floridian roots. He had started early, of course, dropping out of school and working full-time for his father at the age of 16. By the time he was in his early 40s, Compson Construction had a presence, if not a solid competitive foothold, in a dozen major cities scattered throughout the Ohio River Valley. He had an innate talent for reading the palm of urban sprawl and for picking the project that would bend the forces of municipal evolution to his will. He tended to avoid the hot and heavy vogue markets, preferring instead those communities on the cusp of identity, teetering between yet to be and never will. He underbid and overperformed, as though the business of building and making money was set to music. The lenders loved him. Charles Compson had not moved his family from Florida all the way to Canal Winchester, Ohio, for business reasons. It was true that a business headquartered in Columbus was more in keeping with the geographic scope of the Compson Construction business model than was Miami. But it was also true that Ohio offered distinct advantages over Florida in managing his labor and equipment needs. Nevertheless, the move had been more for personal than business reasons. He had built a large but tasteful, modestly appointed home near Jackson Lake, on the outskirts of the quaintly historic Canal Winchester, only 20 miles outside of Columbus, because beneath all his success and urban polish, he resonated with the vibrations of a simple life, led by a set of simple values. His grandfather on his mother's side had come from Pennsylvania Mennonites. His father, although stubbornly non-religious as an adult, had been raised Pentecostal. Unassuming frugality, doctrinaire certainty of purpose, and an innate distrust of moral complexity were all in Charles Compson's blood. Compared to the cacophonous, color-colliding, morally pungent Miami free-for-all, the relative simplicity of Ohio, its quiet, rural celebration of Rockwellian Midwestern values, struck a chord in Charles, like the aroma of an apple pie cooling on the windowsill, that told him this was a place to call home. Financially speaking, living in Canal Winchester had made Charles Compson a very big fish in a very small pond. A whale in a bowl of goldfish. The median income of Canal Winchester residents compared to that of the Compson family annual income in the same way that Jackson Lake compared to the Gulf of Mexico. He certainly could have chosen to live among his economic peers. Indeed, he did own houses, condos, and other home-like structures in which he and his family slept and ate and stored their luggage while vacationing. Maui, Vail, Manhattan, Cabo San Lucas. But a man's home, the place he actually lived, defined the man himself. Charles Compson III believed himself a man of unquestioned virtue, uncompromised by success because, in spite of so much opportunity, he was made of simple tastes and drawn to simple pleasures. A modest man of great means. The size of the pond was the whole point. When he was not traveling from one project site to another, which was often, Charles relished the antidotal simplicity of home. With a population of fewer than 5,000 souls, the municipal corporation of Canal Winchester was classified as a village by the state. He could walk to the Methodist Church, where his wife Alice stayed true to her mother's example as an active community organizer for the good of the faith. He developed personal relationships with each of the 7 members of the Canal Winchester Village Council. He joined the Lions Club. He took turns coaching Little League and sponsored village entrants in the annual Columbus Soapbox Derby. Had there been an annual frog jumping contest, Charles Compson would have raised frogs. And all this bucolic Americana was a scant 20 miles southeast of Ohio's capital and the largest city where Compson Construction counted its money and kept its books and received service of process. It was, in a word, perfect. The Vanguard Academy completed that perfection. Charles and Alice Compson brought with them to Ohio their 6 criminally attractive children and their very strong opinions about the corrupting influence of the public schools. The schools in Miami had inspired trouble-prone Charles to drop out and to join the real world early, the first in a long, unbroken string of highly lucrative decisions. That decision had been mostly practical, a weighing of his chances of graduating against more immediate rewards. But by the time he had his own children to educate, Charles's opinion of public schools had merged into his evolving Randian personal philosophy that tended to pit the inherent virtue of the individual against the acquired depravity of the collective. The key to a successful life, he thought, lay in the struggle against moral compromise. Melting pots, he concluded, bred the contagion of personal corruption. Come out from among them, and be ye separate. Charles Compson III had therefore moved to Ohio and built his own damned school. An academy is what he had built, a refuge for intellectually gifted children with parents who were discriminating and disinclined to wallow in mediocrity. He had financed the construction of the school and its first year of operation using Ohio First Securities and Credit money, for which he had pledged 2 of his commercial properties, a shopping mall near Jefferson, and a Columbus office complex, as collateral. The deal had been shepherded by an up-and-comer at OFSC named Hollis Johns, whom Charles seemed to like a great deal, and whom he had taken to calling and inviting out for drinks whenever a new project struck his fancy. Charles Compson thought Hollis Johns had his finger on the pulse of things in the state of Ohio, and he often told him so. "You and I are going to do a lot of deals in this state, Hollis," Compson had told Hollis once, after too many drinks. "A lot of deals. Stick with me and I will stick with you and I will make you one wealthy son of a bitch." Charles Compson, in other words, was a good man for Hollis to know. And when, in the flush of male bonding over drinks and a very fine dinner in downtown Cincinnati, Charles had asked about Hollis's children and had personally encouraged Hollis to enroll his son David in the Vanguard Academy to ensure he received a quality education, by which Charles meant the finest and well-screened teachers from around the country, no expense spared on class materials, and a principal recruited at a very high price out of his position as an associate dean at Yale, Hollis had had no choice. "Call my girl at the office and she'll get you an application. Send it to me and I'll take care of the rest. Your boy is just the material the academy is looking for." Susan had eventually relented, not agreed exactly, but she had deferred, as she had been increasingly apt to do in those years. Hollis's conviction on the issue had proven stronger than both her reservations about the Vanguard Academy and her idealistic affinity for the concept of public education. That, and Hollis certainly was the breadwinner. She could not get around that irrefutable point. The money from Columbus First Savings, the pre-merger incarnation of OFSC, had been spectacular compared with their modest beginnings. The move out of Dayton to Columbus had not been entirely necessary. The commute would not have been onerous, especially since they had blossomed into a 2-car household. But Hollis had felt the pull of Columbus. It was not enough to work there and to still live in Dayton in the house paid for and furnished by his mother. Dayton had become a child's suit, pinching him under the arms and leaving his ankles exposed beneath the cuffs. He had blamed it on the commute, but both of them had known that that was simply a stand-in argument, substituting for reasons that defied articulation. Susan had relented. They had sold the Dayton Gift House and purchased another, bigger and better in every respect, located in a well-kept neighborhood only 20 minutes outside of Columbus proper. But while Columbus had meant big opportunities for Hollis, Susan's career had foundered, both as a result of the move and the rearing of 2 children. "You can teach there as well as you can teach here," Hollis had said, consolingly. But that had not proven to be true. The Columbus market for teachers was much tighter than it had been in Dayton. Had she really pushed, she might have found a position, a grade school, that was right for her. There was a grade school position in Westerville that might have worked. Or she could have commuted to and from Dayton, keeping her old job in the school that she loved. But she had not pushed. There was David to consider, and little Tilly. They needed her first. Hollis was doing what he could to support the family. Up early and home late and gone plenty of weekends. OFSC did not acknowledge the concept of banker's hours, or at least Hollis did not. He would not be able to feed and dress children just so that she could commute to and from Dayton. Hollis had not said or done anything to foreclose the option, except to suggest the hiring of a nanny as their best option. Susan was not hiring a nanny. Hollis did what he could, and she would do what she could. The upshot was that Susan's value, her contribution to the family, was not easily or intuitively monetized. Hollis made the money. She made the bed. Hollis wore the pants. She, the apron. If there was ever a question about beds or aprons or food preparation, then Hollis would defer to her judgment. But if it was about spending, or investing, which was his word for spending, the paycheck he brought home, then Hollis expected her to put in her 2 cents and then step aside. And for the most part, she did. The issue of the Vanguard Academy had provoked more resistance than normal, only because it concerned things like education and her children. These were issues in which Susan had a greater than normal interest and experience, and, for the same reason, Hollis had been more solicitous of her views than might otherwise have been the case. Susan's opinion of the Vanguard Academy had never been one of outright opposition. She did not have enough hard information to completely oppose the idea. Instead, she had counseled a niggling skepticism, a dogged resistance to acknowledging the Vanguard Academy as the spectacular opportunity that Hollis believed it to be. Hollis saw that she could not shake her educational romanticism, and that she had equated a quality secondary education at a well-funded private school with a kind of social elitism that simply rubbed the fur in the wrong direction. It did not help that she disliked Charles Compson, whom she had once met at an OFSC Christmas party and found to be rather disdainful and aloof, an opinion which Hollis did not share, and which he had chalked up to the man's extraordinary rectitude and formality when it came to dealings with women. Charles Compson had not bowed exactly upon his introduction to Susan, but there had been a slight rigidity in his manner, a perfunctory genuflection in the eyes that betrayed the wariness with which he always seemed to receive the opposite sex. "He is no friend of women," Susan had opined later, removing her earrings. "Who, Charles? You're misinterpreting," Hollis had said. "Chivalry and manners on the outside, all pig on the inside." "Oh, come on," he objected. "That's a little harsh. He's just very proper, respectful." "Didn't feel respectful. Creepy, maybe." "Creepy? I know when I'm being sized up," said Susan. "Are we talking about the same man?" "Yeah, Mr. Darcy meets Count Dracula," she said. "That one." "Well, I like him. I like him a lot. Hell of a businessman. He's taught me a lot." "Oh, I have no doubt he's a hell of a businessman." "And a hell of a family man," added Hollis. "Someone married him?" she asked. "Oh, yeah." "Then I pity her." "She worships him." "I'll bet." "He worships her, married for 20-something years, rock solid." "So?" "So?" "So it's just every other woman he holds in contempt." "Contempt?" Hollis had almost laughed. "I thought you said he was sizing you up."
"Same thing."
"Is it? How'd you like to be reduced to a set of pecs?" "I saw respect. I didn't see contempt. You've got him all wrong, Susan."
"He called me madam."
"So?"
"So he's barely older than we are."
"So?"
He squeezed the tips of my fingers.
"So?"
He never looked me in the eyes, not once.
You're imagining.
Really?
It had been Susan's turn to almost laugh.
How would you know? You took off to fetch him a glass of wine.
Fetch? I was just being polite. It was our party. He's the client.
Fine. But while you were gone, I felt like I was two tits and the plague.
You're very attractive and he's very proper. Very traditional.
Yeah, she said. As in, women have their place traditional.
No, as in, any woman who is not his wife has her place traditional.
And I'm telling you that my place is in the apartment he keeps in the city.
I just don't... That is not Charles Compson.
He is very well respected in this state. He's a millionaire many times over, totally self-made. He came from nothing. Wholesome upbringing, good values. He's no Don Juan.
I didn't say he was Don Juan. I said he was a pig. Don Juan loved women.
Susan, we go to the same Rotary Club. All the women seem to like him just fine.
Rotarians, she said, dismissively.
Who else?
Well, Milena seems to like him when he comes in. So does Iris.
Iris likes him?
Seems to.
So then it's just me, she said.
Like I said, he's very formal with all women.
The formality is a cover, Hollis.
It's just how he is. You'd like him if you got to know him. You should hear him talk about the importance of family and how Alice occupies the center of his universe.
He says these things.
All the time.
What kind of business meetings are these, anyway?
The friendly kind. He talks a lot about his family, about his wife.
Do you talk about yours?
Me?
Yes, said Susan. You.
I don't know. Yes, I have, I guess.
What have you told him?
That I have one, a wife, a family, basic stuff.
Male bonding through commiseration?
No, just good business.
I bet he's one of those men that keeps his wife locked away to keep her pure, contained, uncontaminated. Alice sits alone with the kids as he's off making his secretary take dictation.
No, nope, not Charles Compson.
What does she do?
Alice? Oh, they've got four or five kids, or six.
Six? Is she a rabbit?
Her hands are full. She's got a teaching degree she doesn't use.
Sounds familiar. Ever met her?
Once.
A looker?
Not really. Kind of matronly. Tall. Gray hair in a bun. Sweet face.
Smart?
No idea, said Hollis. I've never spoken two words to her.
Because?
Because I have no dealings with her. I have no occasion to see her.
Tonight was a Christmas party, Hollis.
Strictly business for Charles, I assure you. He probably went to six of them tonight. Why would he bring her along for all of that?
Because she's the center of his universe, remember? Can we drop this?
Sorry, sweetie. Susan's tone had softened. I'm just giving you a hard time. You get to pick your own friends.
Client.
Whatever. He clearly likes you.
He says he's got big dealings with the bank.
I didn't pry, even though I think he wanted me to. It's a couple of big office complexes downtown. Also wants to build his own private school.
A school?
An academy. All hush-hush. Still in the thinking stages. Limited to exceptional students. He says he can recruit Ivy League talent to run it, but he wants Alice to be a vice principal to make sure it stays a quality operation. Well, well, see what I know. Yeah, that's hardly keeping her locked up.
Okay, okay, she said, conceding. Uncle, I misjudged.
I'm telling you, they work as a team. Charles is totally squared away. He's got his priorities. Alice and the kids come first. Always. Other women are outsiders. They get the formal treatment. Respect, but never too familiar. That's all it was.
Oh, Hollis, don't be so defensive. I'll take your word for it.
Of course, Susan had not really taken his word for anything, reserving her opinion in perpetuity for further evidence that Charles Compson was a closeted misogynist Lothario. When, eventually,
After the academy was in its final phase of construction, Hollis had broached the issue of David's attendance. It was clear that Susan's initial negative impression of Charles Compson had been well preserved, a fact that only served to fortify her more fundamental objections to the idea. Susan certainly had not been convinced that Hollis's success at OFSC depended on an academic association with this single client. She did not have a good understanding of the highly personal interplay between banking and business, and while Hollis had repeatedly tried to make the point, it never stuck. She would just have to trust him. To her credit, she had not challenged him on his home turf. Nevertheless, selling the academy to Susan had been an uphill battle, and because David was her son as much as he was his, Hollis had forced himself to go through the process of making the sale, to have endless discussions, answer her questions, have the debate at a level at which she could fully participate. It was important, he knew, that she be a part of the process. And in the end, she had relented. For it was his name, not Leonard or Leonard or Leo or Marianne or Susan, on the paycheck. For Hollis's part, he quickly put to rest any doubts about whether the Vanguard Academy was a worthy investment. He knew that well before David had graduated and received the first of many diplomas, he would have distinguished himself from the others, separating himself from the herd, paving the way for his little sister, and setting the tone for the future. The John's name would not soon be forgotten, not by Charles Compson or anybody so privileged as to be associated with the Vanguard Academy. That, unfortunately as it turned out, was the only sliver of the future that Hollis had accurately predicted. Hollis pulled past the school, not seeing any sign of Ben in the windows. He accelerated, losing David in the rearview mirror of his memory. How right he had been about all that, he thought to himself, and how horribly, horribly wrong. The thought of going home filled him with a strange, nameless anxiety. He told himself it was a new sense of freedom. It was a wildness inside him that he felt. Something feral, clawing at his heart, did not want to go home. No one was waiting for him. No one needed him. Food was not growing cold. The coming of trash pickup day did not demand his attention. His time was entirely his own until 2:30, and he would not be asked to account for one single minute of it. He drove to a filling station and topped off the tank, even though he had filled it less than a day earlier. Rather than swiping his credit card at the pump, he sauntered inside and paid the full $5.38 out of his pocket. He tried to engage the clerk. Buckeyes banter, the weather, the cost of gas, but she wasn't having any. He drove down the block to the wine cellar and purchased an Australian Shiraz to go with dinner. Steaks tonight. He and Ben would cook out on the grill. He made it back to the car and then decided to go back in for a nice Bordeaux, just for good measure. He carefully placed the second bottle next to the first in the back seat so they would not roll into each other, and then he climbed in and drove on, navigating solely by impulse. He headed north, then west, then north again, turning almost at random, but gradually working his way to the freeway, as though the car had a mind all its own. He snapped on the radio. Haydn. They were always playing Haydn. Not always, really. It just seemed like always at the moment. Normally, Hollis would not have minded, but now, inexplicably, he was tired of Haydn. He was tired of being the person who did not mind Haydn playing when the car radio turned on. He pushed the scan button, listening to one station after another for 30-second intervals. After three country western stations, two pop stations, and a heavy metal station, Haydn was quickly regaining his appeal. Hollis lingered over an oldie station as Buffalo Springfield wrapped up For What It's Worth, but he was unwilling to sit through Viva Las Vegas, and he let the channel go.
But she is being used, people. Used. The left-wing wackos are playing on this woman's grief for political gain. The radical liberal element is simply taking advantage. That's all there is to it, folks. They will put this woman, Cindy Sheehan, on a bumper sticker and slap her grief across the backside of every car in the country so that they can convince the world that America is an evil empire invading other countries just for blood sport. And with all due respect for...
And back to Haydn. Hollis turned off the radio and merged into the broken metal stream flowing south along the I-71, still not having any idea where he was going. He could, he thought, just swing by the OFSC to say hello. Not long enough to bother anybody, just to sort of check in. They would still be buzzing about Wally Nunn's retirement party. Maybe that was what he needed, a little of the old camaraderie. He wondered how many would ask after Beth. How is, what was her name again? Say, Hollis, that sure was a lovely woman you had on your arm the other night. Hollis, you old bull, you're no more retired than I am. These idle musings brought her back powerfully to his senses. The yellow dress. The voice. The smile. Her perfect hand. The smell of her skin just beneath the ear. The taste of her mouth on his. The electric charge that had bound her naked body to his heart as he lay her back on the bed and kissed her goodnight. Hollis identified, suddenly, the strange and nameless anxiety that had kept him from going home. The knowledge filled his veins like a thick serum, pressurizing his limbs and curling his fingers around the steering wheel. It was not freedom that had agitated him, but a new captivity, a new longing that could not be satisfied. It was Bethany. It was Beth clawing at his heart. Beth. It was his need for her, his memory of her, the itch he could have scratched but now could never reach. He had been a damn fool. That was what was at home, alone, waiting for him in the quiet of his study. He exited the I-71 on autopilot, still in a reverie. It was not until he had stopped at the light and taken stock of his surroundings that he realized the source of the impulse to exit. The word, on its iron-stilted perch, blazed yellow out over the land like the beacon of a lighthouse, at once beckoning and warning. Waffles. He took the back booth, their booth, by the window, looking out over a fleet of 18-wheelers. From the kitchen, behind the swinging doors, something hit the floor. A man was laughing. There was a smell of bread and grease and eggs cooking. Waffles, 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 he remembered. And he was suddenly with her again, right across from her, her perfect foot mere inches from his. What he wouldn't give to know where Beth was at this very moment, and what she thought of him. Hollis jolted upright as, "Hello, I'm Ruth," slapped a short amber glass of water down on the table in front of him, along with a menu.
"Dining all by your lonesome this morning, aren't you?" she said in a way that wasn't a question.
Hollis smiled perfunctorily, knowing she cycled through such hokey greetings as a matter of course. She was not remembering him specifically. She looked down on him, torturing a piece of gum in the back of her mouth and somehow smiling wryly at the same time. The gum popped under the pressure and began naming names.
"Guess she wised up on you sooner rather than later, didn't she?"
Hollis looked up at her, stupefied.
"Don't look so glum there, hon. You'll see her again come the rapture. Oh, and we're fresh out of the special skillet."
Pop.